Jerusalem has long been the focal point of the still unsolved problem of Palestine.
There is no Palestine, no Palestinians, there never was, there never will be.
Palestine, Yanesh, ni Palestine.
One of the things that I'm still figuring out, even after all these years of producing these episodes, is how to best tell the Palestinian story. There are so many ways to approach our past, and so many threads to chase and connect. But it is becoming increasingly clear to me that Palestine's political and social and economic histories really are at least 4 deeply interwoven stories, each with their own special points of focus, with all 4 of these stories colliding spectacularly in the 19th century. Some of these stories I have already spent a lot of time on, and others I have, up to this point, dealt with rather poorly. The first story through which we can understand Palestine's past is the Ottoman story. And by that I mean telling a story that focuses on Palestine as an administrative unit of the Ottoman universe and analyzing the ways in which Palestinians negotiated their public life as Ottomans. This is the story of things like the Tanzimat reforms and their impact upon Palestinian life. Up to this point, I think I've dedicated a significant amount of time to this narrative lens. Closely related to that is a second story, the urban story, through which the focus becomes the social, political, and economic dynamics of Palestine's urban spaces. This is the kind of story that allows us to walk the streets of Al-Quds with Yusuf Diya al-Khalidi, or spend a few evenings with Haj Salim Efendi and his friend Jurjes Jauhariye. This is the story that allows us to attend the weddings of the Tuqans and the Husseinis. And those who are interested in the social history of Palestine may notice that we have spent a lot of time in the urban past. And that is due in no small part to the fact that urban Palestinians left a better paper trail, making them an easier subject of study. The problem is that urban Palestinians only made up something like 20 or 25% of Palestine's overall population in the late Ottoman period. And so to know what most Palestinians were up to in the late 19th century, one has to look beyond these urban spaces. And so there is a third story, the peasant story, that we need to peruse in order to understand the world of most of Palestine's inhabitants. The vast majority of Palestine's inhabitants were peasants, after all, scattered in villages all over Ottoman Palestine. Now, anyone who knows me and has been listening to this podcast or has attended any of the lectures that I've had the pleasure of delivering over the last several years knows that I have a soft spot for the stories of the peasants. My last 2 season finales focused on Palestine's peasants and their place in the Palestinian collective memory. And this was no accident. But there is a fourth story, and it is the one that I have, up to this point, severely neglected. It is the story of a group that have been known by many names over the millennia. They have been called the Arab, the Arab, Urban, Ahl al-Badia, or simply the Bedou. They are the Bedouins. And today, There are millions of Arabs all around the world who descend from Bedouins that just a generation ago jealously guarded their nomadic way of life. And to this very day, and despite the best efforts of regimes all over the Arabic-speaking world, there remain Bedouins who continue to practice a nomadic lifestyle. And it is to my great regret that up to this point, I have reduced the Bedouins to the role of peripheral characters in the story of Palestine. And part of my neglect probably stems from the fact that my paternal ancestors were urban Palestinians and my maternal ancestors were peasant Palestinians. And so, unlike some of my listeners who may be of Bedouin stock, the stories that I heard growing up were predominantly urban and peasant in nature, but not Bedouin. But there are other, less personal and more systemic reasons as to why the Bedouins have found themselves on the margins of the story so far. Turns out that most of the work on Palestinian history also peripheralizes Bedouins as a distinct group of, well, others who live beside but not necessarily with urban and rural Palestinians. And many historians have reduced the Bedouins to really little more than a problem to be solved and eventually overcome by the Ottoman state. As one article puts it, Bedouins have been portrayed as passive victims of urban-centered policies or as a disturbing element that suddenly and unexpectedly entered the scene, apparently following a logic unrelated to that of imperial politics. Now, the article goes on to say, quote, "Historians working on the economic, social, and cultural history of empires in the early modern and modern Middle East have tended to subsume the Bedouins under the rubric of the periphery," end quote. The Bedouins of Palestine and its hinterlands are the custodians of a rich oral history. But most of what we know about the Bedouins does not tap into those oral traditions at all. Instead, our understanding of the Bedouin is derived mostly from the written works of other groups who felt compelled to write about the Bedouins. And just knowing that we rarely get to hear the Bedouin voices, helps us better understand why the Bedouins have been so terribly neglected in the story of the Palestinian people. And so, to redeem myself and Palestinian historiography at large, I will give the Bedouins the place that they deserve in Palestine's history. And I will do so by spending quite a bit of time viewing Palestine's story through Bedouin eyes. We're going to stay here for a while, and the end result will almost certainly be an overcorrection, but I think it's worth it. And I think it's worth it because when you look at Palestine through Bedouin eyes, like I have for the last several months, you realize that this whole story that I've been telling you for years, this story that began with the arrival of the Ottomans in 1517, the interrelations between towns, the rise of Dhahr al-Umar, all of it could be retold through Bedouin eyes. And you'd really leave with a very different picture. Now, I'm not going to retell that whole story. Instead, I'm going to impress upon you just how significant the Bedouins were to Ottoman Palestine by first explaining that their mere presence was like, it's like a vortex, it's like a force of nature that could alter the lives of every Palestinian around them. And if you think I'm exaggerating, then just try this. I want you to dig deep into your imagination and picture yourself traveling through late Ottoman Palestine. Now, it's late at night and you arrive at the outskirts of Al-Quds or Haifa or Jaffa or Gaza or almost any other Palestinian town. So what do you see? Well, the first thing that you should see as you approach any of these Palestinian cities were their walls. And in some cases, these walls were decaying and falling apart, while in other cases, they remained perfectly intact. And in places where these walls were functioning, such as Al-Quds, guards were stationed at the entry and exit points of the city, closing the gates every night to ensure that nothing came in and nothing got out. Now, at this juncture, I imagine that you have the same question that I had when I stumbled across that architectural feature, and that is, who were these walls trying to keep out? Well, the first thing these walls were trying to keep out were wild animals. Food storages were located typically inside the city walls, and wild animals could definitely make a mess of things. Animals also posed a pretty serious threat to young children. You know, for most of us, particularly those living in urban spaces, it's kind of hard for us to imagine a time when dangerous animals ruled the world, but that was true outside of urban spaces until relatively recently. But the other more significant thing that these walls were designed to protect urban centers from were the Bedouins. And for hundreds of years, stretching back to a time long before the arrival of the Ottomans, the Bedouins were a force to be reckoned with. No one had better animals for the arid landscape which they inhabited. And no one knew that landscape better than they did. And there was certainly no one, no imperial power, no military force, who could dissolve into the endless expanse of deserts quite like the Bedouins. The Ottomans knew this when they conquered the Mashriq from the Mamluks. In fact, all the way back in the Mamluk era, a military commander made it his obsession to hunt down and subdue the Bedouins. And the Mamluks had a nickname for him. They called him a cloud chaser. And that really is a perfect description when it comes to articulating what it must have been like trying to subdue the Bedouins in the frontier regions at the edge of settled life. The name Bedouin itself comes from the Arabic word badia, which means the arid frontier, and the places that most listeners today would find unlivable, the Bedouins called home. And so looking at things through sedentarized eyes, you can see just how easy it is to arrive at these long-held romantic perceptions of Bedouins as a kind of exotic other, a human storm of marauders and highway bandits kept away by walls and citadels. That characterization of the Bedouins, which permeates through the entire historical record, is something we've generally been getting from the people inside the city walls. And it does not tell the full story. And so I am going to do my absolute best to shatter the walls that exist in our minds and perhaps change your perception of who the Bedouin were and how they fit into the Palestinian social fabric. And I want to lead with three important points to help you navigate this portion of the Palestinian story. The first is that the Bedouins were a highly adaptive group, capable and willing, responding to the social and political and economic changes of their times. The Bedouins of this story are not some window into centuries past. Ottoman perceptions of the Bedouin changed wildly over the course of the 19th century alone, especially after the Tanzimat, and again after the ascendancy of Sultan Abdul Hamid. And this has led me down a spectacular months-long rabbit hole, and you will see that the Bedouins continued to adapt in this ever-changing world in order to maintain their lifestyle and their survival. The second thing that you need to keep in mind for this portion of the story is that the Bedouins were and continue to be a far more diverse group than our ill-equipped, sedentarized eyes are trained to appreciate. I want you to think about it like this. St. John's, Newfoundland, and Istanbul are technically both cities, right? I mean, they both have mayors and councillors and roads and buildings. They both have urban plans. They're both home to sedentarized populations. But the two hardly feel like the same thing. And in much the same way, Bedouins vary tremendously in their size, their lifestyle, the animals that they're reared, their propensity for engaging in violence, their relationship with the Ottomans, their relationship with peasants and urban notables, their commitment to nomadism, how far they traveled in that nomadism, and the degree to which they were comfortable with the idea of sedentarization. We refer to the Bedouins as a single social category because their unique nomadic way of life set them apart from their neighbors. But that common marker aside, the Bedouins were remarkably diverse. The third and final thing I will say about this highly diverse group that I hope will help you better understand this part of the story is that the Bedouins did not live fundamentally separate lives from their urban and peasant neighbors. No. They were deeply ingrained into the local surroundings. I mean, as one historian puts it, quote, "Historically, Bedouins and their partners in social interaction have generally formed part of one regional political economic system and generally had more in common with their partners in this regional system than with the Bedouin groups outside of it." End quote. Despite the fact that enormous Bedouin networks dotted the Ottoman world, the Bedouins of Palestine were more similar and connected to their urban and peasant neighbors than they were similar and connected to other, more geographically distant Bedouins. The fact that so many myths relating to the Bedouins persist to this very day justifies the deep dive that we are about to undertake. All right, so let's get into it. When the Ottomans defeated the Mamluks in the 16th century and began their rule over the region, they came into a world where the Bedouin were already firmly woven into the fabric of local power structures. The lands where the Bedouins were the most dominant are called many things depending on the frame of reference of the author. I mean, they're sometimes referred to as frontier lands, barren lands, wastelands. These are all common names for the places that the Bedouins call home. But maybe the most accurate descriptor of their home would be arid spaces. The arid spaces of the Ottoman East. And Palestine had no shortage of arid spaces. I mean, the Naqab in the south or the Jordan Valley to the east, both of these would be described accurately as arid spaces. And this holds true for almost the entirety of what sits at the eastern bank of the Jordan River in what is the modern-day Kingdom of Jordan. Now, I guess this is as good a time as any to ask the question of how did they arrive there? And so I'd like to take this opportunity to go into the origin story of the Bedouins themselves. Now, all the way back in the first episode of this podcast, I mentioned that the ancient Greek historian Herodotus made note of the Bedouin presence in Palestine all the way in the 5th century BC. And by then, they had already been there for a very long time. Now, this gives us a great indication that the Bedouin as a social group have been a part of Palestinian life for a very, very long time. But that should not deceive you into thinking that the Bedouin of the 19th century, in their entirety, were the direct descendants of the 5th century BC Bedouins observed by Herodotus. Now, the truth is that some of those ancient Bedouin communities did, most probably, continue to exist as Bedouins in the 19th century. But many others of that ancient group had slowly sedentarized over the centuries in Palestine's villages and cities, making them indistinguishable from urban and peasant Palestinians. I mean, the Abdul Hadi family, for example, one of Nablus's most prominent urban notable families, are reputed to be of Bedouin origin. Meanwhile, just to complicate this picture a bit further, while some Bedouin families sedentarized over the centuries, other nomadic communities moved into Palestine over the course of those hundreds of years and, well, Bedouinized. I mean, according to an article titled Bedouin Settlement in Late Ottoman Palestine and Early Mandate Palestine, there were 43 nomadic tribes in Palestine at the time of the Ottoman conquest. And of those 43, a substantial number were of Turkish and Kurdish origin. The most notable example of this phenomenon are the nomadic Turkmen tribes of Palestine, whose contested origins go back hundreds of years. By the 19th century, many of these Turkmen tribes, while retaining much of their language and customs, had also thoroughly Arabized. And so when I say Bedouinized, what I mean is that those tribes adopted the customs and the language of the local Bedouins. Now, one mystery that has not been studied thoroughly enough is determining where these Bedouins came to Palestine from. The common wisdom among, I guess, casual observers is that Palestine's Bedouin must have all come from the Arabian Peninsula. But we've already seen that this could not possibly be true, since some of Palestine's Bedouin were of Turkish and Kurdish origin. So thankfully for me, historians really began to take more seriously and, you know, document the oral histories of Bedouin families about in the 1990s in order to get a better sense of kind of the Bedouin self-portrait and also to try and understand the origins of the Bedouins. Now, unsurprisingly, these oral histories are rather soft on, you know, facts and figures such as dates and demographic data, but they still have proven to be an incredibly insightful source in piecing together the Bedouin story and their origins. Now, on this subject, one historian writes, quote, "The Bedouin themselves generally had oral histories of their tribal origins stretching back hundreds or thousands of years, including grand migrations throughout the region. In the Bisan Valley, for instance, Arab al-Saqr, that is a tribe, claimed to originate from the Hejaz or Najd in Arabia. And the Ghazawiyya tribe traced their lineage to the tribes of Hauran. Hauran is a region in southern Syria." End quote. Other Bedouins, such as the Ghawarina, they were a tribe who inhabited a swampy, reedy area surrounding Haifa. And they were inhabitants of a land so distinct that some historians concluded that they must have come from Egypt's Nile Delta and developed a resistance to malaria along the way. And so you get from this a picture that they have a very diverse set of origin stories. And so, by the Hamidian era of late Ottoman Palestine, we have ourselves a case where something like 5 to 10% of Palestine's overall population belong to semi-nomadic Bedouin tribes, each with their own unique backstories that could be traced back decades or centuries or millennia, and whose numbers seem to be growing. For a very long time, there was no indication that the Bedouin lifestyle was going out of vogue in the Ottoman East. By the late 19th century, according to a map produced by the Palestine Exploration Fund in 1880, there were 67 Bedouin tribes. And while we do not have precise numbers on the membership of these tribes, That represents a 66% increase in their numbers over the period of Ottoman rule that led up to that point. And this makes perfect sense when you realize that for the first 300 years of Ottoman rule in Palestine and in the surrounding regions, there was nothing out of place with the Bedouin lifestyle. I've said on this podcast before, and I was quoting Baruch Kimmerling and Joel McDowell, that the state is the enemy of the Bedouin. And there was another source that put it more broadly. They said, quote, "The state is the enemy of people who move around." But for the first three centuries of Ottoman rule in Palestine, there was no contradiction between Ottoman aspirations and the Bedouin lifestyle. The Ottoman political philosophy that governed its relationship with the Bedouins could be traced back to the work of the 14th century Islamic polymath Ibn Khaldun. Now, Ibn Khaldun proposed that civilizations follow a cycle wherein they begin as nomads, eventually settling, developing a civilization, only to later be overrun by other nomads. To Ibn Khaldun and to the Ottomans, nomadism was a natural part of the human existence. The Ottomans themselves were descendants of semi-nomadic steppe peoples. And since nomadism was here to stay, maintaining good relations with nomadic communities was just a necessary part of the Ottoman imperial strategy. And this is where I want to focus now. I want to shift away from the origins of the Bedouins, and I want to look more carefully into the relationship between the Bedouins and the Ottoman administration, and between the Bedouins and their neighbors. And regarding these relationships, I have found no better source than historian Noura Barakat. Her book, Bedouin Bureaucrats, describes how the Bedouins of Palestine's frontier found themselves at any given time on a spectrum of cooperation or conflict with the Ottoman state. Now, she refers to this spectrum as the Bedouins' fears of submission. I'm going to try to unpack this as best as I can. From the 16th to the 19th centuries, the Ottomans relied on partnerships with local actors, most often Bedouins, to collect taxes and perform other state-like functions. Zahir al-Umar was a Bedouin up until a generation before he was born. And protecting the Hajj pilgrims as they traveled through frontier lands on the way to Mecca was one of the most important responsibilities of an Islamic empire. And the practical application of that protection was the responsibility of Bedouins. As part of this Hajj administration system, the early 19th century saw massive gatherings of Bedouin take place just about 100 kilometers south of Damascus. And these were annual meetings of tribes that took place a couple of months before the Hajj pilgrimage. And at these gatherings, the Bedouins of Palestine and Syria and the surrounding areas would gather to essentially bid for the opportunity to be contracted out as the protectors of the Hajj pilgrims. And they earned that contract for either part of the journey or maybe even the whole journey. And the leader of the tribe that won this lucrative contract was, for a time, known as Sheikh al-Shamal, the leader of the Bedouins of the North. In this case, the North basically refers to the Levant. So again, the very legitimacy of the Ottoman Empire rested on their ability to protect the Hajj pilgrims. And they needed the Bedouin protection in order to safely navigate through these arid parts of the Hajj journey. Arid spaces that the Bedouins knew better than anyone else. So it would be accurate to say that for much of Ottoman history, partnering with local Bedouin tribes was a central part of the Ottoman administrative strategy. when it came to tax collection, dealing with insubordination, and administering the Hajj. Now, at the very same time, this begs, I think, an obvious question. Why did the pilgrims require so much protection? And from who? And the answer was other Bedouins. And this is what Nur Barakat means by spheres of submission. What she means is, it is the degree to which the Bedouins were willing to submit to the Ottoman state, or any other state for that matter. Some of the Bedouin tribes saw themselves as being in cooperation with the Ottomans, and they felt that that was the best way to secure their future, to maintain their lifestyle, and expand their influence. Even prior to Ottoman rule of Palestine in 1517, it was already a regular feature of the Ottoman administrative strategy in other areas to use nomadic tribes to move around in the areas where the empire feared it was going to lose control in frontier regions. Using nomadism to extend imperial control was really a normal part of Ottoman governance, and there were no shortage of tribes willing to take them on in this endeavor. And while some tribes chose to cooperate with the Ottoman authorities, others maintained a lukewarm relationship with the state, having no formal partnership with the Ottomans and choosing instead to provide for themselves through a mix of animal husbandry and farming. Others still carried a more antagonistic attitude toward the imperial authorities. And for the Ottomans, dealing with the antagonistic tribes was a nightmare. I mean, like the Mamluks before them, the Ottomans quickly discovered that colliding with the Bedouins could mean battling them in inhospitable moonscapes wherein the Bedouin clans would dissipate like a gas, only to reappear in physical form somewhere else. To confront the Bedouins, the Ottomans needed other, sometimes more powerful, Bedouins. And in addition to that, some expensive infrastructure like military forts. I mean, here's a really good summary of the situation. Quote, lacking a permanent presence on the ground, the Ottoman authorities in Damascus relied upon the manipulation of tribal rivalries and the prompt payment of annual tribute to local sheikhs to ensure the safety of the pilgrims. Despite the elaborate military political infrastructure, the logistical problems ensuring the safe passage of the Hajj procession across an arid and sparsely inhabited terrain remained daunting. Matters were made more complicated by the fact that the Hajj was a mercantile exchange as well as a pilgrimage of devotion, one that involved tens of thousands of people, the population of a large, early modern city. The goods carried by the pilgrims to offset the expense of the journey were a tempting target for the Bedouin that lined the pilgrimage route. In order to further reduce the pilgrims' vulnerability to attack, the Ottomans undertook an extensive program of fortress construction that fortified the pilgrimage road and pushed it east to the very limits of the farming frontier. Now, the author goes on to say, quote, matters were made worse by the wider diffusion of handguns and muskets among the empire's nomads in the 17th century. End quote. So now you could look at the lifestyle of some of the Bedouin clans and their attacks on caravans and merchants and pilgrims. You could look at all of that as an expression of barbarity. But for a moment, I want you to look at this landscape through Bedouin eyes. I believe that the Bedouins had a better understanding of power and sovereignty than most political scientists today, and I sincerely mean that. They understood that sovereignty was not rooted in international agreements or a seat at some table at a European conference. No, sovereignty was indistinguishable from your ability to enforce your will upon a land that you claimed as your own. They understood that to travel through the land where they reigned supreme without acknowledging their supremacy in those spaces was akin to trespassing and violating their sovereignty. And that held true irrespective of how pious your travel plans were. If you want to travel through the arid spaces surrounding Palestine, you best pay or take permission or make special arrangements. Simply put, the Bedouins really did view themselves like mini states in these arid spaces. I would also like to encourage you to not jump to conclusions and start mentally juxtaposing good, benevolent, pious Bedouins who protect Hajj pilgrims against the heathen highway robbing Bedouins. It would serve you well to keep in mind that these tribes very well could swap roles depending on the status of their incredibly fluid relationship with the Ottoman authorities. A tribe that was granted the right to protect pilgrims one year may find itself attacking pilgrims another year after they fail to secure a renewal of their contracts or upon, I don't know, a falling out with the Ottoman authorities. On the whole, there was a geographic logic animating the spheres of submission and the Bedouin willingness to cooperate with the Ottomans. Proximity to the Hajj routes made Bedouins more likely to seek positive relations with the Ottoman authorities. And so the principal point to understand here, as we dissect the relationship between the Ottomans and Palestine's Bedouins, is not that the Ottomans dealt with the good Bedouins and battled the bad ones. Rather, the key point is that both those who cooperated with and those who competed with the Ottoman state did so in a rational way. And just knowing that allows us to throw into the rubbish bin of history the idea that the Bedouins were in a perpetual, never-ending, and irrational struggle with authority. In truth, their relationship was much more complex. As Astrid Meyer and Tariq Tell put it, quote, "Instead of the ultimate outsiders who threaten the political, social, and moral order, tribal elites often appear to act as an integral part of the coalition of merchants and bureaucrats that intermediated imperial rule." End quote. For most of the Ottoman era, the Bedouins were an integral part of the imperial strategy, at least as often as they were hindrances to it. They protected pilgrims, collected taxes, and enforced Ottoman authority, while some among them simultaneously undermined all of those efforts. Yet despite how clear the historical record is on the diverse history of the Bedouins, the stink of reputation as mere disruptors holds firm. Similar myths also shape our understanding of how Bedouins related to their urban and rural neighbors. And that is where I want to turn the discussion next.